All right, with me back, a three-peat or four-peat guest, Doug Valentine. He's an American journalist. He is a poet. He's one of my favorite authors, and he has a new book called The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. And we've talked about the CIA before in programs. We did some interviews about Ukraine. He's had some books on the Phoenix program. He has a lot of books on organized crime. Organized crime is not just the mafia that you see in Hollywood. Well, it's not even that either, but this book ties everything together of all your previous books that I've read. That's what it did for me, at least. And I want to talk to you about the CIA and how you put this together. How did you get the CIA to trust you in the first place?
That's a long story. The book is divided into four sections. The first one's about the Phoenix program as the model for the war on terror. And the second section's about the CIA's involvement in drug trafficking. The third is about the Phoenix program as the model for homeland security. And then the fourth section's about the CIA's involvement with the media. The most important aspect of the CIA and the Phoenix program is the control of information, making people believe certain things, making people assume certain things through censorship and psychological warfare. So I'll finish off with that.
And false heroes, the kind of journalistic celebrities. And we can talk about some of those
elsewhere. Well, yeah, but the whole book is prefaced by two interviews I did about my getting access to the CIA, which is a story in itself, which is what you just asked me about. And how did I get inside? For the last 30 years, that's the question that everybody's been asking me. I had to get to know all this, and I never wanted to actually write about myself. The personal pronouns really don't appear in my book. And I just tried to write about the subject. But eventually, my publisher, Diana Collier, for this new book, thought that it was kind of her idea to do this comprehensive approach where, a section on each of these general subjects, and then to begin it with an explanation of how I got the access, because it doesn't make sense to people unless you know what happened. And it has to do with the fact that I wasn't a celebrity, and I didn't go to the I wasn't a celebrity reporter. I didn't go to the Columbia School of Journalism, so I didn't know what the rules were for how to approach the CIA. If you go to the Columbia School of Journalism, where you come up through a newspaper like the New York Times, and you start out as a cub reporter, they shape you. And, like the same way if you join the CIA as a young CIA officer, slowly over a period of time, you get indoctrinated, you learn what the rules of the game are. And if you prove that you can conform to the institution and what the institution requires of you, then you advance, and you eventually, if you're really smart, you become a manager, and then you impose all those rules, unspoken rules and guidelines, on the newcomers coming up. And that's sort of how the system regenerates itself, whether it's the journalistic institution or the CIA institution or academia, or any of the systems and institutions that combine together to form the United States. And whatever it is as a, whatever people try to define it as, it's a self-correcting system that weeds out anybody that isn't ideologically, that can't be ideologically assimilated, is rejected. And the system it constantly recreates itself in this way more perfectly all the time. But I came into it as like a virus, and I didn't come into it as I came into it as a nobody. and it had to do with the first book I wrote. I have to explain a little bit. My father was a blue collar guy, worked two jobs. My mother worked. When I got to college, I didn't really want to be there. I liked writing and I liked literature and I always read, but I wasn't really suited to be indoors. And as soon as I got a high draft number and I wasn't going to be drafted and sent to Vietnam, I became a tree surgeon and I climbed trees for a living for close to 10 years. I liked being outdoors. And I didn't have a very good relationship with my father, but after his second open heart surgery, he called me up and he said, the doctors told him if he ever wanted to get better, he had to tell about what happened to him in World War II. So he called me up and he said, I know you want to be a writer. Come on home. I got a story to tell you. And he told me about what happened to him in World War II. And I wrote about that. I had just gotten married and I had supported my wife when she went to college and to graduate school. So she said, we agreed I could take a year off and write this first book. And I wrote the book called The Hotel Tacloban about my father's experiences in World War II. And a book got published. And now all of a sudden I'm a writer. And I didn't know what to write about next. I decided to write about the Vietnam War. I wanted to write about a facet of the war that hadn't been written about. And so I started talking to Vietnam veterans, and they all said, well, you know, there's this thing called the Phoenix Program. I said, well, what's that? And nobody really knew much about it. And so I did a little research, and I found out that there was a guy named William Colby who had been the director of the CIA. And Colby had actually run the Phoenix program in Vietnam for a couple of years. And like I said, not knowing any better, not being intimidated by the fact that Colby was a director of Central Intelligence, and not knowing that a nobody is supposed to just approach him and ask him for an interview, I wrote him a letter and asked for an interview because I figured that was the logical place to start. And I sent him a copy of this book about my father. And Colby called up. And I said, yeah, I like your book. Come on down. We'll talk about it. So I went down to his law office in Washington, D.C. I cut my hair and put on a suit and tie and told him what I had in mind. And because of this book about my father, Colby knew that I knew what it meant to be a soldier. And he felt that I would be sympathetic to the CIA guys who were involved in the Phoenix program, because CIA officers think of themselves as soldiers. The CIA is organized as a military organization. Somebody tells you what to do and you salute and you do it. There's not a lot of, there's no discussion, you know, and Colby himself had been a soldier in World War II with the OSS. He'd parachuted into France, and worked with the Maquis, the French resistance. And it was, you know, soldiering. Plus it was spying. And so Colby thought that I want to understand the situation that soldiers are in who were involved in Phoenix program. And so he agreed to help me out. And, you know, I mean, again, I did not realize at the time that this was unusual. <You know? laughs> It wasn't until I got I was kind of a guy recently described me as Odysseus. In a review of this book, you know, the wily trickster who tricked his way into the CIA. And that's sort of true, because as it started going along, I realized that the unusual circumstances had put me in a position. As long as I played it straight, these guys were telling me all their deepest, darkest secrets, because they thought I would understand. And not only did they think I would understand, which of course I did, they thought that I would be sympathetic to them, which is where the sort of hustle, if you want to call it, came in. I simply approached it from an organizational perspective. You know, I had told Colby I wanted to demythify the Phoenix program. So I approached the subject organizationally, which, you know, not in a sense of getting into the lurid details and did you kill anybody? I never asked anybody I interviewed any of those kind of questions, you know. But all that stuff came spilling out in the process of just presenting myself as this sort of objective blank slate. All these other details came out in the process. And the thing that Colby did was, and to understand Phoenix was a coordinating mechanism. By 1966, Lyndon Johnson had realized that the United States military alone could not win the war in Vietnam. And he had an advisor, a CIA guy named Robert Comer, who told them that the only way the war could be won was to pacify the civilian population and to destroy the secret government that supported the Viet Cong insurgency. It wasn't enough simply to fight the North Vietnamese army and to fight Viet Cong guerrillas. You had to pacify the entire civilian society in South Vietnam, and you had to do this by killing off and capturing this underground secret government. So Comer, with who worked directly for Lyndon Johnson, Johnson sent Comer to Vietnam in '66, and Comer told the head of the CIA station there in Saigon, a guy named John Hart, that he wanted Hart to create what was called a general staff for pacification. That this general staff for pacification would bring together all the American military and all the South Vietnamese military and police and security organizations under the direction of the CIA and target all these disparate organizations, all of which had been operating independently of each other. And it would put their leaderships together in this general staff for pacification and target them under the CIA direction against the civilians of South Vietnam and the leadership, and their leadership. And Hart gave the task to a CIA officer named Nelson Brickham, who I interviewed at length. And all my interviews with Brickham are available online at a couple of websites, Crypticom, and another one that was put up by a guy named Michael Best. So if you want to listen to my interviews with Brickham, you can. It's all there. And Colby sent me to Brickham. And Brickham told me exactly how he put together this general staff for pacification, which when it was instituted in the summer of 1967, became known as the Phoenix Program. And what it did was it created an executive staff, which was headed by this guy named Robert Comer, initially. And it had the chief of military intelligence, the chief of the CIA station chief, the CIA's head of revolutionary development, which was all its covert action programs in South Vietnam, which were actively involved in pacifying the civilians, and a few other people. And they created a Phoenix Directorate in Saigon, and Colby chose a guy named Evan Parker to head the Phoenix Directorate. Parker was a senior CIA officer who had been in the OSS with Colby. They'd known each other for 20 years. And this was the guy who was the rank of like a major general. And Colby introduced me to Parker. And I interviewed Parker, and he told me all about how he set up the Phoenix Directorate. And then what the CIA did under Parker was to establish, and this is the essence of the Phoenix program, what were called intelligence and operations coordinating centers. These became what were the Phoenix offices, and they set one up in every region. There were four regions. The region oversaw all the provinces in the region. There were 44 provinces in South Vietnam, so one of these Phoenix centers was set up in every province. And then they set up one of these IOCs, intelligence operations and coordinating centers, in every district, which is like a county.
This is so solid.
It's like a state. And so within 6 months, they had this entire system, which Brigham set up and which Parker ran out of Saigon, in every province, which is like a state, and in every district in South Vietnam. There were 244 of them. And so down to the district level, every military intelligence organization, all the CIA programs that were being conducted, and there were dozens of them in South Vietnam, all the South Vietnamese police and security operations, all these different agencies and organizations all had informant networks. Now, all of a sudden, in these Phoenix centers, all of these, they're suddenly sharing all the information that these informants are bringing together. And they're targeting them not against soldiers, not against the enemy soldiers, but they're targeting it against civilians. And when Phoenix was examined by Congress in 1971, one of the congressmen said, so if Abraham Lincoln had a Phoenix program during the Civil War, it would have been targeting people like the mayor of Macon, Georgia, right? Civilians, political leaders. And that's what it was. And it was totally illegal. The people who were targeted had no right to due process. One of these informants for one of these many organizations, if he didn't like a guy, if the guy had stolen his girlfriend, or if the guy was a rival in business, or if the guy had some kind, if his dog peed on his lawn, he could inform on somebody he didn't like and say, this guy is a member of the secret organization. And the Phoenix program would then get that information. And because this guy was now a suspect, they could send out a hit team to capture them and bring them to one of the interrogation centers that the CIA had set up around South Vietnam. Starting in 1965, the CIA built a secret interrogation center in each of the 44 provinces in South Vietnam. And they turned them over to the special branch of the South Vietnamese police. And these interrogation centers were not interested in the Viet Cong guerrillas. They existed specifically to target the secret members of this of the underground insurgency government, civilians, people like a woman who was in the Women's Association or a district leader who organized a farmers association in a particular district that supported the insurgency. And these hit teams that the CIA also set up, mercenary hit teams, which would become the most famous part of the Phoenix program, would go out and snatch this woman, bring her to the interrogation center where she would be tortured until she ratted out everybody she knew. And if you didn't know anybody, because you weren't actually, you know, a member of the insurgency, they still worked you over anyway. And this was the essence of the Phoenix program. It didn't matter whether or not you were a member of the insurgency. The whole idea was to terrorize. Now, this is the psychological warfare part of it. To terrorize everybody into South Vietnam, to make them be afraid that if they indicated in any way in the smallest way that they supported the insurgency, that them and their family would get killed. So it was billed, the Phoenix program, when it was finally revealed in 1969, two years later after it was created, was billed as protecting the people from terrorism. just like everything that's going on in the United States. We're told that the war on terror that we're conducting overseas is done to protect us from terrorism. It doesn't matter that it means supporting ISIS in order to overthrow the government of Syria, or that it means supporting ISIS in Iraq in order to make sure that the Iraqis can't generate enough political and social energy to break free of the American occupation. Same thing in Afghanistan. You know, we're told that we're there protecting Americans from terrorism, when in fact, the CIA and the military special forces are protecting drug smugglers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And using them to create a parallel government, which just terrorizes everybody. And it's been terrorizing everybody for 15 years. And the most important thing to understand is that Phoenix has become the model for the Department of Homeland Security. And just like Phoenix set up these intelligence operations and coordinating centers across South Vietnam, the Department of Homeland Security has set up fusion centers in the United States. Every state has a fusion center that functions exactly like a Phoenix Intelligence and Operations Coordinating Center. In these fusion centers, every law enforcement and civic organization and FBI informant operation is brought together, and everybody shares all their informants and all their penetration agents into the anti-war movement or into the environmental movement, and it's all highly computerized. Phoenix was had a big computer in Saigon, and all the information was computerized so that guys like William Colby could go through it and pick out the most perfect targets for assassination or for to try to recruit. The CIA oversaw the whole thing because it could pick out, you know, what it considered the highest value targets. And this is exactly what's happening in the United States today. And, you know, one of my little articles is called Phoenix Comes Home to Roost. I was writing about it I was predicting it in 1990, and I was writing about it in 2000 and 2001 when the Department of Homeland Security was created. And I pointed out at that time that the guy who was hired as the chief of staff of the original Department of Homeland Security was a CIA officer named Bruce Lawler, who served in the Phoenix program in South Vietnam. And all these guys at the time, all these CIA officers who were part of Phoenix, they all realized that this was the future, that Phoenix was the future. Not only is it the way, the highly systematized coordinating mechanism for putting down and controlling social and political movements in foreign countries, but it's the way to do it here in the United States too. At the very center of it is the control of information and the relationship that the CIA has with the media. And as we see unfolding today, there's virtually no difference between the media and the CIA. At the highest level, they are the exact same people and they have the exact same goals. Just two last things. I begin this new book with a quote by a guy named Johan Galtung. And he says, personal violence in domination is the tool of the amateur. The professional relies on systems to dominate people. And this is exactly what Phoenix is. Phoenix is a system. It's a methodology. It's been highly refined. It's technological. It combines psychological warfare, the control of information, with theories of implicit and explicit terror, how you can coerce people just by the threat that could be harmed, or the threat that they're being surveilled. All the information that comes out to us about the blanket surveillance, I mean, that's meant to intimidate us, you know. I mean, it's not helping in any way, you know, but we're constantly barraged with all sorts of information that molds us and molds our assumptions about what's going on. And most of it is very untrue, and most of it is designed merely to make us feel and think and behave in certain ways. And the other part of it, the other thing that I tried to emphasize, and this was insights that we got from 50 years ago from a guy named Guy Debord. Guy Debord, 50 years ago, in a book called The Society of the Spectacle, said, secrecy dominates our world. And foremost, as the secret of domination. And this is where the media comes in. It doesn't tell us anything about the CIA. It doesn't tell us how these systems are dominating us, or how the establishment uses all these highly refined systems, like the Justice Department and Jim Crow laws, tax laws that benefit the rich. Instead, they focus on sort of, you know, the sensational crisis of the day, without ever revealing to us anything that we really need to know about how the whole, about how our society and political systems are organized. And it's this selective presentation of facts and news that's created all the confusion and allows a guy like Donald Trump and his alternate reality to get elected, because we really don't know what's going on, and we really don't know how to deal with it. And so this new book of mine, The CIA is Organized Crime, tries to give it the whole sweep and scope of these systems as they were developed starting 50 years ago in South Vietnam, and how they apply today, and how you can unravel it. I mean, and you can unravel it, and you can see what's going on. And once you see what's going on, you can hold your, you know, so-called elected representatives. You can hold their feet to the fire, but it takes a lot of study, and it's not an easy thing to grasp, and you really have to work at it. And it's not something that happens in a minute. Anyway, so that's it in a sort of a half an hour nutshell.
I imagine
talking to Parker got you
the respectability of other agents. I was wondering if people in the CIA didn't think you were in the CIA because it's so compartmentalized that they must assume, okay, he's been sent here to ask something or not. And probably your background in philosophy and literature helped you more than a background in journalism would have, because you could talk to Parker about, you know, Welsh literature and those kinds of things and get that kind of rapport, which is more important than if you had gone in asking the hard questions right away. You would have been turned around, most likely. A couple of other things in the book I wanted you to touch on, because you did talk about the Phoenix Program as a method and template for the Department of Homeland Security, but also in the title is Organized Crime, and you mentioned narcotics in Afghanistan, and this is in a lot of your other books too, but, you know, how did the Phoenix Program meld into the CIA taking over the Federal Bureau of Narcotics and completely controlling the drug trade as they do now?
Well, it's political and ideological in nature. It has to do with the nature of American capitalism, okay? And it goes back to, you know, there's a historical arc to the subject of the CIA is organized crime that you need to understand. And so I'll go back to the beginning, but it starts with just how the United States evolved. And up until the 20th century, it was pretty much just concerned with its westward expansion to the Pacific Ocean and defining its boundaries with Mexico and Canada, and establishing an industrial base which it did. I mean, by the time the 20th century began, the United States was the biggest industrial country in the world. But even in World War I, the United States was neutralist. It went into World War I kicking and screaming. You know, there were a lot of, you know, President Wilson objected to it until the very end. And even after World War I, the United States did not join the League of Nations. And as a result, the sort of a parallel government was created, and it was managed by very wealthy individuals like Nelson Rockefeller, who created the Foreign Policy Association. And the Foreign Policy Association worked with all the members of the League of Nations as sort of a de facto government over for, you know, State Department, and it represented the interests of the industrial elite, America's economic elite, that had interests overseas, in like Japan or Cuba or South America, places where what were essentially American privateers were operating. And when World War II erupted, President Franklin Roosevelt went to these people, these privateers who were operating overseas, and these were the people that formed the OSS. These were the people who, like William Pauley, had an airline in China and had connections in China and could be used to establish agent nets in these countries where all of a sudden the United States wanted to operate. And so Roosevelt wanted it to be a civilian organization and not a military organization, but it had a military function of creating, of conducting sabotage and subversion in a lot of these other foreign nations. And so the OSS was formed by this faction, this sort of overseas faction of the United States. And when the CIA was created after the war, these are the people who became its managers. People like Alan Dulles, who had been part of the Foreign Policy Association, and they had all the connections. But part of their function had always been to work with criminal organizations in the countries that they were going to sabotage and subvert. Even in France, I talked about Coley parachuting into France in World War II. And Evan Parker did the same thing in Burma. These guys worked with criminal organizations. They established, one of the groups that they worked with in France was the Corsican Underworld.
Mm-hmm.
And the Corsican Underworld was hired by the OSS and engaged in all sorts of sabotage and subversion against the Nazis. And when the war ended, and of course the communists had been at the forefront of the resistance in France, and the CIA wanted to create what was called a compatible left in France, it relied on the Corsican gangsters to break up strikes on the docks in Marseille. And a lot of these Corsican gangsters were drug smugglers. And so they got a free pass to smuggle drugs as long as they started operating against the communists. And the same thing happened in China. And as you know, the same thing happened in Japan, where the CIA worked with the Yakuza. Anybody who, and the CIA's connection with the Kuomintang government in China is the foundation, along with its association with the mafia in the United States, which was hired to help the CIA and the United the OSS and the American military in its invasion of Italy during World War II, and afterwards to fight communists in Italy. The mafia worked with the Christian Democrats in Italy, again, for the CIA, against the communists, and then in return, they got a free pass to traffic in narcotics. As long as it went to blacks in America, it was considered okay, and they worked with the Corsican gangsters, and they worked with the Kuomintang Chinese, which the United States have been supporting since 1925, and I outline this in the book. For 20 years, the United States, even before there was a CIA, was allowing Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang Chinese to traffic in narcotics because that's how they funded their regime. And after World War II, when the Kuomintang moved to Taiwan, where they assassinated and massacred tens of thousands of people, the CIA and the Kuomintang set up the biggest drug trafficking network in the world. And they did it, and it operated out of Burma, where a Kuomintang general, Lee Mi, was established and was supposed to conduct paramilitary operations to subvert and sabotage China. And in order to pay for it, they allowed this guy to traffic in narcotics. And they said, well, it's okay, as long as the narcotics remain in the Far East. But that's when the CIA set up the biggest narcotic trafficking organization in the world. And they plugged it in and connected it with the mafia and with the Corsicans. And it projected into the Golden Triangle of Laos, Thailand, and Burma, and from there into South Vietnam, where all of America's clients, the major generals, who were fighting the communists, were allowed to have opium franchises and to make a little money on the side. Same with the politicians. I mean, Diem and his brothers who were in charge of South Vietnam under American auspices from 1954 until 1963, they supported all their intelligence and security operations through CIA-sanctioned drug trafficking. I mean, so this is just a way to CIA roles.
Yeah, even the Shah family had...
Yeah, drug trafficking is just one facet of its connections to the underworld. When the CIA needs assassins, now it has people in the Corsican mafia, in the Italian mafia, in the Taiwanese mafia, in the Japanese mafia that it can go to and say, we need you to bump off somebody. We need you to conduct we need you to break in and steal something here or there. I mean, they have an entire stable of people that criminals and mercenaries that it has formed into militias and private armies all around the world. And these people are sustain themselves through their criminal enterprise, and in return are protected by the CIA. I mean, this is why there's so much crime in Mexico and down in South of America, because the CIA uses these people, these criminal organizations, and it arranges for them to become leaders, the heads of political and social movements all around the world, and it allows them to make fortunes, personal fortunes, through all sorts of illegal activities, including and primarily arms trafficking and drug trafficking, but also pornography, any other kind of criminal activity that you want to get involved with. And they run the whole thing. And because the CIA has a station in every country, and because it has all this super sophisticated technology, it can coordinate it just like a Phoenix intelligence and operations coordinating center. And it's the same thing. It's integrated into the CIA and how it operates and how it rolls around the world. And this is how it destabilizes countries that it wants to destabilize, like in the Ukraine. Anywhere you go, it even does it against its so-called allies. You know, I mean, it has these relationships in the United Kingdom. It has these relationships in Australia. And it keeps its relationships with the criminal underworld active in all these countries. So if they start getting a little bit out of line, like Joff Whitlam did in Australia in 1975, they can pull a hammer down. And this is why I characterize the CIA correctly as the organized crime branch of the United States government. Whenever they, and of course Congress goes along with it the way, you know, any mafia boss goes along with it. The mafia boss says, no drug trafficking. No, we're not going to go drug trafficking, you know. And then all the mafia guys go out and they drug traffic as long as they don't tell the boss about it and give them a kickback. It's fine, but, you know, I mean, it's set up to be plausibly deniable. And the media covers for it, and the media is perfectly well aware of it and covers for it at every step of the way.
Well, the media will lose access if they're ever honest. And that I wanted to talk about a little bit about these fake heroes, these celebrities like Daniel Ellsberg. The Pentagon Papers were leaked on purpose, and not many people know that. They think that, oh, wow, this hero leaked these papers and ended the war. That's sort of the dumb leftist version of history. And in modern times, we've had our Greenwalds and maybe to a lesser extent, Scahill making a movie about himself. They don't really show you even the tip of the iceberg, but they get all this the press from the rest of the press about, oh, look at this heroic figure, and he's telling you things that are really already known by anybody that is getting news from anywhere other than the mass media. Already knew about, like, WikiLeaks' helicopter shootings. Like, that, I've seen that video, things like that, for 6 years or something, you know, and reported on them myself. And then all of a sudden, this is on Time Magazine and everything else, and so you get an over-focus on sensationalist stuff. Even good journalists like Cy Hirsch focuses on the kind of gore and assassination parts of things, but not really didn't explain the system, didn't go, you know, lift the rock up enough. So, well, that is a loaded question, but the Ellsberg example, if you can talk about that, like the Pentagon Papers, how was that really on purpose? And why?
Yeah, well, you know, again, going back to, like, you got to see how the thing evolved, okay? And again, having you got to take a broad approach to it. You can't, you know, if you want to see how Ellsberg fits in, you have to understand that we live in a capitalist society. And again, Guy Debord does a good job in describing this. 50 years ago, I mean, like you talk about, it's all obvious. All the facts are out there. It's true. You just got to put them all together. But he talked about the role and the function of celebrities. And a guy like Greenwald, or Scahill, or even Daniel Ellsberg,
Amy Goodman.
They create a brand for themselves. They represent something to people. They symbolize something. And in our capitalist society, where we're barraged every day with advertisements that are selling us things, in order for these guys to sell themselves, to promote themselves, they have to create a brand for themselves, an image for themselves that represents something, you know. And what they do is they pitch it to an audience that is already in agreement with them, you know. And so Greenwald says, you know, I'm telling you the truth about the National Security Agency. Or Greenwald says, I'm telling you the truth about mercenaries. And in the meantime, all they're doing is selling themselves as a product, and they're really not explaining anything in the kind of depth or in a fashion that reveals the contradictions of capitalism. Because if they were to do so, they would then subvert themselves, and they'd no longer be able to sell themselves as products. They're commodifying themselves, and they're selling themselves as products to people who have been conditioned to buy the stupid bourgeoisie message that they're selling. And Ellsberg falls into that too. It's a little more complex than, and it may not seem like I'm making sense in a way to you right now, because you...
But no, it's like...
It's complicated, but, But for example, with Ellsberg, and Ellsberg, there was a movie made about him, and in the movie, and in his autobiography, he talks about his time in Vietnam in a particular way, and he says that you know, the Pentagon sent him out there to study different programs that were going on and that the government, the military was conducting in the villages. And in his autobiography, he devotes about a page to it. And in the movie about him, he's seen walking around in an army uniform as if he was working with a military uniform, a military unit. In reality, the 2 years that Ellsberg spent in South Vietnam, he worked with the CIA. His mentor was this guy, General Edward Lansdale, who is whose programs were incorporated as one of the major features of the Phoenix program. Lansdale's this guy who helped set up what were called armed propaganda teams, which operated under cover of Civic Action. Lansdale was featured in Graham Greene's book, The Quiet American, as a guy who is setting up medical dispensaries around South Vietnam in order to do good deeds to the South Vietnamese. And in the meantime, the CIA is creating informant networks through these, you know, medical teams that they're sending around the country. And they're conducting terror operations. And Graham Greene tells how this guy who's modeled on Lansdale actually sets off a bomb in the middle of a square in Saigon, kills hundreds of innocent people, and they blame it on the Viet Cong, and they, you know, it's a typical black propaganda operation, which justifies then the military, U.S. military coming in and killing, you know, thousands of people. Well, this was Lansdale, and Lansdale was Ellsberg's mentor in South Vietnam, and Ellsberg doesn't talk about that. He doesn't talk about how he worked with these programs that were designed to pacify the South Vietnamese population. And these were the original Phoenix components of the Phoenix program, and how he worked with a guy, Lucien Conin, who had also parachuted with Colby into France in World War II. Conin had worked with the Corsican gangsters in France during World War II. He'd actually been inducted into their underworld association and given this medal. And in 1965, Conin and Lansdale came to this, and Al McCoy talks about it in his book, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia. Lansdale and Conin, who Ellsberg is intimately involved with, reached a truce with the Corsican gangsters that were bringing in all the opium, much of the opium and heroin that was coming from the Gold Triangle into Saigon. And they hired these guys as informants, and they used them. And when I asked Ellsberg, I did an interview with him about it, I said, so tell me about how Lansdale and Conin worked with these Corsican gangsters who were involved in the drug trade. And he said, oh, absolutely, they didn't. And just absolutely contradicted everything that Al McCoy said was going on. And at the same time, I mean, it gets even more intriguing. And because I interviewed Conin, and Conin told me all about it, Daniel Ellsberg was having a love affair with a woman named Germaine, who was one quarter French and three quarters Vietnamese, just this absolutely gorgeous young woman whom he met at the Cirque Sportif, which was this French club, athletic club, And anyway, he's starting an affair with her. And Germaine was the girlfriend of a guy named Michel Seguin, who was one of the top Corsican gangsters involved in the narcotic trade in South Vietnam. And this guy, Michel Seguin, actually went to a villa where Lansdale, where Ellsberg was living, and put a gun to his head and said, "Stay away from my girl or I'll kill you." And this whole episode erupted into a gang war between the CIA and these Corsican gangsters in South Vietnam. But nowhere in any of Ellsberg's biographies or autobiographies or the movies that are made about him, well, you hear about it. And when I wrote about this stuff, I was permanently banned from all of the left news media organizations that thrive by having Dan Ellsberg on as a guest, because all of a sudden I had revealed his connections to these really vicious, vile CIA guys, and I'd shown his involvement in their assassination and kidnapping and psychological warfare programs. And if anybody on the left, Amy Goodman, or the people at The Nation, or even other people who benefit financially as part of their brand from having Ellsberg on to talk about nuclear war or any of the good things he talks about. But if you actually reveal the truth about the guy, like I did, then you get censored. I mean, and it's just as bad as, for me, it was devastating, because I, you know, was really trying to reach out and show new history. But the word went out. Valentine told the truth about Ellsberg, so never have him on your show. And that's how it works. And it's a CIA influence.
That's why I get all the
people. That is pervasive throughout our entire media. I mean, it's as bad in the left as it is on the right, which is why some guy like Trump could get elected, because everybody knows the left is just as phony as the right when it comes to protecting, again, its economic interests in a capitalist society, which depends on branding people in a certain way so they can sell commodities. And in our society, the news is a commodity, and it's sold like a commodity. To The Nation sells a certain type of news to the bourgeois audience that flocks to it because they really don't want to know how bad things are, but they want to think that they can have some small influence, you know, and it just goes on and on and on. And anybody who's truly a leftist or truly a dissident and truly wants to fight the CIA is totally marginalized and ignored. That's how, you know, I mean, that was my experience, but I'm not the only one that experiences this. If you go around and you show the connections between the CIA connections that anybody on the left has, then your career is ruined, because you refuse to be assimilated into this system of commodifying and selling yourself, which everybody has to, you know, tacitly agree to in order to get the word out. I mean, you experience the same stuff.
Yeah, and that's why I get all the black sheep on my show, because they're the best. Because, like, oh, if you can't go on other shows, then you got to come on my show. I met Daniel when he came to speak at my college, though.
You know, since anytime I write about Ellsberg or Gay Hill or Greenwald and point out the contradictions between their image and what they're actually doing, I mean, people get really offended and mad at me. And all I'm doing is telling the truth, you know, but it's upsetting the apple cart. You got to understand what this apple cart is and how it's rooted in capitalism and commodifying individuals and taking away your humanity and turning you into a brand that can be sold.
Well, the guy that's got the best goods on Skay Hill is, in my opinion, is Thomas Mountain, who lives in Eritrea. And he's done real work on the real terrorism and what USAID has been doing, arming rebels. And he was like, Scahill was there. It just didn't explain this mountain of information. He's like pointing at some drone in the desert. It was just like, you know, just a little flea flick of info. And a guy like Thomas Mountain, he writes like you do, and he knows. I've learned so much about Africa and neocolonialism from this guy, and he's got the goods on Scahill. And so the good and the real serious writers are out there. But I wanted to share you something about Daniel, because he came to my school before the Iraq War.
Who did?
Ellsberg.
Oh, okay.
And as like a total celebrity, like debutante type, his little entourage and everything else. And maybe I was a little bit ahead of the curve, but I got up there and I started asking about the Office of Special Plans, which are these neocons that cherry pick things and let. And this pissed me off so much. I happened to be wearing like a Croatoan necklace, whatever. And he completely avoided the question about the Office of Special Plans and went on some long speech about how he loved Native Americans and started to cry because of his friend Sundance Wolf or something. And just like, it totally avoided it. I wish I hadn't worn the necklace, because he wouldn't have thought I was an Indian, and he wouldn't have. I was like, he did not want to talk about the OSP or any of that. And I have a feeling he definitely knew about it. I just didn't want to talk about it.
The person who introduced me to Ellsberg was Peter Dale Scott. Peter Dale Scott and Daniel Ellsberg are best friends. And Peter Dale Scott liked my book, The Phoenix Program, and he liked the stuff I was doing about drug trafficking. And when a couple of CIA officers that I interviewed for the Phoenix program, in particular, a guy named Frank Scott, who's featured in this book, The CIA is Organized Crime, and with whom I did lengthy interviews. Caldy sent me to Frank Scott. Well, Frank Scott and Dan Ellsberg lived together for a year. I mean, they shared the same villa. And Scott was like Conan and Lansdale, intimately involved, not only in the CIA's underworld connections with the Corsicans, but in all the assassination and interrogation and armed propaganda and psychological warfare programs that were conducted. And again, all these guys told me about their relationship with Ellsberg, and I talked to it about these relationships with Peter Dale Scott, not knowing that he knew Ellsberg. And he said, well, look, I'll get you to talk with Ellsberg and he can tell you his side of the story. So, I mean, I did go to Ellsberg and I did confront him with all this stuff and I did write about it. But the first thing that Ellsberg said to me when I called him up and when we talked, he said,
you're not a celebrity.
You'll never understand me because you're not a celebrity. And it's this whole idea that once you become a celebrity, you know, like Tom Brady or a movie actor, you know, I mean, Oliver Stone or somebody.
The compatible left.
Or Amy Hoodwink at Hypocrisy Now. Once you become a brand, a successful brand and a celebrity, you lose any connection you have to common people. And I'm a nobody, and I've always been a nobody. And one of the reasons I was able to talk to CIA guys who exist in a covert world where nobody ever knows their names is that they relate to nobodies like me because nobody knows who they are more than they relate to celebrities, which is one of the reasons that they were able to talk with me, because I was a nobody. They weren't on guard. It wasn't like they were talking to Morley Safer or Peter Jennings or Dan Rather. You know, I mean, there was a connection there. But Ellsberg identifies with this class of celebrities. He doesn't identify. He's not connected in any human way with the working class people of this America, who are the people that that really need to know what's going on and who are lied to on a daily basis. And he has no interest in trying to bridge that gap. You know, I mean, he doesn't think it's possible to bridge that gap because he's a celebrity, you know, and he exists in the rarefied air of celebrities, and the celebrities just talk to each other. And when a guy like Bannon, you know, this alt-right guy who is sort of one of the geniuses behind Trump, the other day he gave an interview with the New York Times, and he said, you know, you guys are the enemy. And it resonates with people because working class people across the country know that the celebrities are all bullshitting them. And they're telling them only the things that promote themselves and their brand. You know, the New York Times, it's not helping out working class people. It says, oh, well, the New York Times, the Daily News, that's the working class people paper. If working class people want to know the news, they should go to the Daily News or the Mirror or the Inquirer. But the sophisticated bourgeoisie in America, if they want to know the news, they come to the New York Times, you know. And so a guy like Bannon, and
nobody got the Iraq War wrong more than the New York Times.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's classist, and they represent the ruling elite. And their job is to protect the ruling elite, and they everything they do is again, like I talk about it, the managers in the CIA, the top editors, the publishers, they've come up through the same system that the heads of the CIA and the top generals and the top politicians have all come up through, this system that is the United States system that weeds out anybody who can't be ideologically assimilated. Mm-hmm. And you can't get into any kind of position of power in the United States unless you sell your soul to
these
people.
That's why you need the same catchphrase on the different networks, whether it's too big to fail or we got to get them over there before they get us here. And yes, all the rhetoric we've heard, the war hype, you know, Assad must go, this kind of stuff. It's verbatim, you know, catchphrases like pro wrestling, said over and over again by CNN, by Fox, by MSNBC, etc., the Times, the Post. They all repeat the same message. And how, if they're different organizations, how could they all uniformly, every single time, they support every single war? Like, there's no anti-war voice ever in any of the mass media.
Well, and it's all known. I mean, Fletcher Prouty wrote a book or 40 years ago, called The Secret Team. And he explains exactly how the CIA is able to control all the communiques that come out of the government, and how they're coordinated with the top corporations. A guy named Mills, many years ago, wrote a book about it too. You know, I mean, and how these systems work. But just the other day, I mean, I saw Glenn Greenwald on Fox News talking with Tucker Carlson, and it was like the two of them were having some sort of secret love affair. You know, I mean,
Tucker brands himself as a little bit
they were green about everything, you know, and laughing with each other. You know, it's because they're both celebrities and they exist at this celebrity level. And they have no connection to anybody else that's actually, they don't know have any idea what it's like to work for a living. They don't have any idea what it means to worry about where your next paycheck is coming from. They both got, you know, I mean, Tucker Carlson has Rupert Murdoch, the billionaire behind him, and Greenwald has
Omidyar,
billionaire behind him. And they have, they're celebrities, and they just don't know what it means to live in the real world. I've lost all connection to it, and they have more connection to each other. And you look at them, and it was like that phrase out of Animal Farm, you know, and the creatures looked out the door, and they looked from the man to the pig, the men to the pig, and then they looked from the pigs to the men, and then they looked back from the pigs to the men again, and I couldn't tell the difference. You know, and that's the way it is. I mean, I couldn't tell the difference between Greenwald and Tucker Carlson. I mean, they were the exact same person, both selling their own brand, existing on this level of commodifying American society and American civilians and individuals, and just completely pulling the wool over their eyes for their own economic advantage, because that's how the game is played. And like Trump, anybody who doesn't, and they consider the rest of us losers. They consider, like Trump, they consider themselves the winners. And they have more in common with Donald Trump than they have with average people. And we're the victims. Those of us who are the nobodies.
I think Hillary was just as bad or worse. And quite a celebrity herself, too, in that celebrity class, namesake and everything. But yeah, no one ever really explains what the CIA does. If you ask them, they go, "Oh, they're in intelligence." I'm like, "Well, what's intelligence? Like, what? Gathering information?" They're like, they run the drug trade, they run proxy armies, and they help us target. They use our, you know, modern privateers, terrorist groups to destabilize nations and set up, you know, selective advantages for the corporate cartels that run the world.
Well, I'm kind of pooping out, but all those details are in the book. The CIA's organized crime, and it breaks down the various divisions in the CIA, and it tells you what each of these divisions is engaged in, the difference between foreign intelligence and covert operations. One of the things that Phoenix program did was bring together the various divisions within the CIA itself, which, when they were initially in South Vietnam, foreign intelligence didn't talk to covert action, you know, so Phoenix brought them together, and now all of a sudden they're talking to each other and sharing informants, and so all those details are explained in the book, and it tells you, because I did interviews with the guys who were, you know, when Colby sent me to people in the different branches of the CIA, so I could distinguish them and show how they work together. So that stuff is all there in the book if you want to learn about it. And it's also, there's a few other books that were written long before I started writing by guys like Phil Agee and John Stockwell, Fletcher Prouty, who explained a lot of this stuff too. All the facts are out there, folks. There are no real secrets other than you assuming that you can get facts from the major, you know, from the media, you know, I mean, just don't assume that, you know, go get the facts where they actually exist, you know, in libraries and in banned books, and it'll help to understand.
That's on Clarity Press.
Yeah, Clarity Press does a pretty good job. It was actually the publisher, Diana Collier, who convinced me to do this book, CIA's Organized Crime. It wasn't something that I had ever considered doing it, but you know, she convinced me to do it, and so I'm grateful to her for that, and it turned out to be a good idea. People relate to it and a lot, because I talk about my personal experience, and somehow that helps to me being a nobody. It helps to put things in perspective. You know, it's a book from the nobody point of view. You know, as opposed to a history from the Jeremy Scahill or Daniel Ellsberg or Glenn Greenwald point of view, which is, you know, has no connection to reality.
I like the nobodies in chapter 2 and 9.
Yeah, and at least one of them, if maybe more, were based on my interviews with you.
Yeah, a couple of them are. All right, well, thanks for your time. We'll get this up, and I hope the book sells well, and I appreciate you writing it. I sure enjoyed it. I binge on your books. So after I got The Strength of the Pack first, and then I just went through and got the rest of them.
Well, thanks a lot. And it's always a pleasure to be on the show. And thanks for letting me ramble on and on.
No, I enjoy it. I hope everybody else did too.
Okay, adios.
Stay in touch. Bye-bye.